What is the role of immunotherapy in patients with oncogenic mutations? When is it best to identify these markers?
I think this is one of the most important questions we can address in the interface between pathology and medical oncology treatment, which is how we can best strategize to think about the role of immunotherapy and how it relates to oncogenic mutations. And, at this point, there are numerous studies that point to a clear detriment of giving first-line immunotherapy for patients with EGFR and ALK alterations. I think as you start getting down into that pie of lesser and lesser common alterations, the data are less clear simply because there haven't been enough patients to study for that specific question. But using the precedent of ALK and EGFR, and you really don't need more than that, it really suggests that immunotherapy is best reserved in terms of first-line therapy for patients who don't have one of these targetable alterations. There may turn out to be some exceptions in terms of the specific mutations. And that data will come with time. But for the time being, I think it's super important to recognize that, there's clinical pressure to get therapy started. And we know that there is the opportunity for harm for patients with some markers. And this really speaks to how important it is to identify those oncogenic mutations at the earliest possible opportunity in the patient's treatment pathway.
Can you comment on the genomic landscape of non-small cell lung cancer? What are the important mutations and fusions, and how does identification of these impact treatment and patient outcomes?
I think from my perspective, I think about the genomic landscape of non-small cell lung cancer kind of like layers of an onion. And as you peel one layer back, you get to see what's underneath it, and it's always sort of another level of granularity to think about. To me, the very first layer of the onion in non-small cell lung cancer is frankly histology and immunophenotype, and that allows us to start to categorize the type of tumor that we're dealing with. And in many ways, we think of that layer as informing the next layers. And although there are good rationales for testing squamous cell carcinoma as an example, a diagnosis of squamous cell carcinoma by itself will already start to tell us what some of those deeper layers might look like. For me, the next layer is really about key mutations in key cancer-driving genes. And I'm not talking necessarily about targetable mutations, but really more the biology of the cancer. And sometimes this can be mutations in things like TP53, which contribute to genomic instability. And although TP53 is not something we currently think of as targetable, it tells us again something about that tumor. And the next layer in my worldview is really starting to think about those targetable alterations, mutations, fusions, amplifications. And this is where starting to think about the list of targetable alterations becomes important. People are pretty familiar at this point with EGFR, ALK, and ROS1. Those are sort of obvious things that, should be on the menu for everybody. But as you start to go down the list and into the deeper into the pie chart of mutations, and you start looking at things that are newer and newer, it's harder and harder to keep up. And so I could rattle off a list: BRAF, MET exon 14 skipping, EGFR exon 20 insertions, HER2 amplification is coming down the pike. There's so many different things that are coming down the pike. I don't know that it necessarily makes sense for me to say today, these are the things that matter, because the reality is it could change tomorrow. So from my worldview, this is about knowing what the things are that are absolutely a set thing today, but trying your best to stay on top of what's coming down the pike, because we can flip the switch for those at any moment, which is dependent on things like published data, guidelines, FDA approvals, which, can't necessarily be predicted. I'd like to take it a couple layers further, though, beyond the targetable alterations. And I neglected to mention NTRK 1, 2, and 3, RET, but again, it's impossible to keep up with them in this fashion. Beyond that, you start thinking about computational metrics that are inferred from tumors. And probably the best known of these is tumor mutation burden, which right now we think has less of a role in lung cancer. But there are other computational metrics that are coming down the pike, things like mutational signatures. So, for example, if in molecular testing we see a UV signature in a tumor that's called a lung squamous cell carcinoma, we might rethink whether that really derives from lung. Homologous recombination defect signatures are another example of computational metrics. Unclear yet whether this will have a big role in lung cancer, but you know, it gives you a sense of the type of thinking of how do we take this incredible amount of data we're generating and get yet another layer of information about the tumors. And then, you know, of course, the as you get closer into the center of the onion, I can't really predict how much it'll make me cry, but, you know, I would just sort of call it future omics, because we don't know right now to what extent proteomics, metabolomics, methylomics, et cetera, will really contribute to our clinical thinking about the genomic landscape. In terms of the identification of these alterations and treatment and patient outcome, it's that targetable alteration layer that I think right now carries the most weight. Now, obviously, a histologic diagnosis of squamous cell versus adeno or another type of lung cancer, non-small cell lung cancer, does have treatment implications. I would suggest that identification of things like EGFR, ALK, NTRK 1, 2, and 3, et cetera, have a much bigger clinical impact because they do identify targeted therapies. And those targeted therapies are highly efficacious.
Please describe the strengths, weaknesses of tumor tissue-based testing versus plasma ctDNA. When do you utilize each strategy?
You know, I think one of the amazing things about ctDNA testing is it has really revolutionized how we can go about identifying that initial targetable event. And as we see data emerging, it will also influence how we think about monitoring disease. For that initial diagnostic piece, I think what's really important to understand is that these two methods are truly complementary. And although payers may not want to pay for both modalities of testing, in terms of getting an answer quickly, in large part, I'm increasingly seeing clinical practices adopt both methods simultaneously as a method to get material, to get information back as quickly as possible. ctDNA, one of the biggest strengths is its speed. You can go from a tube of blood, send it off to a lab, and typically within a week you get an answer. The downside is that it does have some compromised areas of sensitivity. So, you know, if you get a ctDNA answer back and it doesn't demonstrate a clear driver, that's when the fallback to tissue becomes really critical. Now, we recognize that one of the weaknesses of tissue-based testing is that if you don't already have tissue on your patient, the timeline to schedule the patient for a new biopsy, wait for that biopsy to happen, get that biopsy processed through pathology, sent to a molecular lab, and then wait for those molecular results can be pretty challenging. And so this is one of the really important ways that these two methods are complementary to each other. When ctDNA is negative, if that tumor tissue testing is also negative, you have much greater confidence that that ctDNA result is not a false negative. So again, I would argue that these two methods are truly complementary, particularly when tissue testing is paired with RNA-based testing, it can be much more comprehensive in the sense of a reduced risk of false negatives.
What are the strengths and weaknesses of focused versus broad spectrum testing approaches? When do you utilize each strategy?
So when you think about testing, one of the biggest advantages to focused testing, targeted testing, tends to be its speed. You can get EGFR and ALK, and in many cases, other fusion answers back relatively quickly. The price for that, aside from whatever you want to think about of cost, because that's not really what I'm focusing on, the price for that is tissue. Doing multiple focused tests uses a lot of tissue. This is where one of the major strengths of a broad testing approach really comes in, which is that for the same amount of tissue you might use for, say, three focus tests, you can get one test that covers an awful lot. So the downside, though, to the broad spectrum testing approaches becomes the timeline. And while laboratories are increasingly getting faster at the testing, it can take, you know, on the quick end, a week, but on the longer end, several weeks to get those results back. The other piece of this really is about the granulars of the technology when you think about DNA versus RNA-based NGS. And, I think the challenge here is really that it's hard to predict which fusions would need RNA-based testing as opposed to DNA-based testing. Now, it's not hard to predict it theoretically, but in real life, there are lots of publications, and we have certainly seen instances where fusions that you might not expect to be missed by DNA-based testing are missed by DNA-based testing. So what I would argue is that although theoretically ALK fusions should have a very low false negative rate by DNA-based testing, it's not zero, right? We have seen instances of ALK rearrangements missed by DNA-based testing. So this is really about modulating your pretest probability and your clinical suspicion. If your testing does not include RNA-based testing upfront and DNA-based testing doesn't demonstrate a driver, that's the time to really modulate in your pretest probability and say, well, do we want to wait for RNA-based results?
What are some barriers to testing? Why are there deficiencies in testing rates in non-small cell lung cancer and delays in testing? What are some strategies to overcome these barriers?
I think there's no tumor type in which we have a better decade-long understanding of practice patterns and adoption patterns than in non-small cell lung cancer. As people all know, there are multiple guidelines that exist: NCCN, there's the CAP-ISLC AMP guidelines, there's the ESMO guidelines. The issue is that adoption always lags. And it's hard to always understand what the barriers are, but there are definitely clear barriers that have been studied. So, I think one of the biggest barriers is the concern about timeline. And there's a very nice study that was published in Cancer Medicine recently that looked at provider reasons for delays or non-testing. And in many cases, what was identified was that the provider is worried about the impact of the testing timeline on initiating therapy. There was also very clear evidence from these surveys that the patients themselves were reluctant to wait for the results of tests. And there was also significant concerns on the part of practitioners that they would send material off for testing and it would come back insufficient. So I think that these are some of the logistical barriers that have existed that have reduced adoption. I think there are also some of the systemic barriers, such as insurance coverage of testing, and whether or not insurance will cover the cognate therapy for whatever is identified. So, I think these are very clear and understandable barriers from the sense that we can quantify them. Trying to figure out how to overcome them, I think, is a multidisciplinary approach.
What are options for patients with no actionable genetic aberrations?
Well, I would argue that the first option is to make sure there are no actionable genetic aberrations. Look very, very closely at what testing was done, what was the scope of testing, what was included. Did it include RNA-based testing? Particularly if your pretest probability is high, make sure you turn over all those rocks. Once you've done that, there are patients for whom we do not find anything, and that is unfortunately just the truth of where we are right now. One option is to understand some of the things that we view as being not actionable. But our genetic drivers help you to understand that you're probably not going to find something actionable. So, for example, KRAS mutations, with the exception of KRAS G12C, are not currently something that we treat as standard of care. But if you find a KRAS mutation, that's a really good indication that you're unlikely to find something else that's actionable. And obviously, if you find a KRAS G12C, that does open therapeutic avenues. So, understanding what constitutes a driver to be able to say, well, I don't need to keep looking, I think are really important. I would say that the, you know, obvious piece here is all about immunotherapy, and that our understanding of how to modulate efficacy in immunotherapy includes lots of different pieces. It includes looking at the entire genomic landscape of that tumor. There's evolving data about co-mutations and the utility of immunotherapy. And then the other place I would point practitioners to are some of the clinical trials looking at antibody drug conjugates. I think that is one of the areas that is really going to explode, particularly in these areas where we don't have a targetable alteration.
How and when do you suggest testing for acquired resistance mutations in patients with non-small cell lung cancer? And what impact can identifying these have on treatment or outcomes for patients?
So, you know, in our practice, we routinely look for these. And just as we routinely look for initiating mutations by multiple modalities, I would say that it's important to look for acquired resistance mutations by multiple modalities if that's an option. For some alterations with targeted therapies, we have a pretty good understanding of what those acquired resistance alterations do to the therapeutic thinking. So an example there in EGFR mutated lung cancer is MET amplification. But perhaps a more granular example is that, you know, as we see evolving resistance to third generation EGFR TKIs, we're starting to see fusions as a resistance mechanism. This now modulates in all of those previous conversations about DNA versus RNA testing. The other thing that I think is really important to understand about acquired resistance testing is that as challenging as it might be to find that initial alteration depending on the sample, we think of acquired resistance as being a subclonal event, which means that you're looking for something that's an even smaller needle in your haystack. And you want your testing modality to be able to achieve that that detection capability. So, you know, there's a yin and yang here between going broad to try to identify as many different possible bypass pathways as possible versus staying focused to be as analytically sensitive as possible. And so I don't know that there's a specific recommendation I can provide for always use test A or test B, because I do think it depends on the clinical situation and the initiating driver. But it is important to understand that, you know, sometimes doing a really big assay on an acquired resistance sample might miss a subclonal event.